Everybody, welcome to another edition of the Journey of Hope. And once again, we're just absolutely thrilled that you could be here with us today. The Journey of Hope is a podcast that's especially designed to address the issues that men and women face after incarceration. We're going to continue our look this week at post-traumatic stress syndrome, but we're going to look at it from an alternative point of view. Philip Brolic is here today, and he's going to be discussing how to address post-traumatic stress syndrome through meditation. Now, this isn't for everybody, but it may work for some. And so we want to surely present ideas that can help people. And this might be something that's for you. Philip Brolic and post-traumatic stress syndrome, addressing it through meditation. That's our topic today. We're going to be right back after this. You're listening to The Journey of Hope, and I'm Rodney Mathers. Love it when you send me an email. I don't need to know why you were incarcerated. All I need to know is how you're doing. I want you to let me know those things, okay? You can catch me at MathersRodney at yahoo.com. That's MathersRodney at yahoo.com. Sure would like to hear from you. Drop me a line. There, welcome back. We have on the phone with us today Dr. Philip Brolic. Phil is the author of Jeffy's Writer, Memoir of a Dharma Who Survived. His expertise is in the area of post-traumatic stress disorder, and through the use of meditation, he's attacked this thing, and that's what we want to speak with him today about. Dr. Brolic, welcome to the Journey of Hope.
Thank you.
First, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I was never incarcerated, but I think the book demonstrates that I have sufficient trauma to comment on the subject of PTSD. I was in the Peace Corps in 1978, my wife and I both, and we were off in the bush having some fun looking for, little villages and so forth, and an accident occurred out in the middle of nowhere in a ditch. My wife eventually died. I got a bad leg out of it. And then I had 3 years of operations and on crutches for 3 years and constant beleaguering of my physical system in the medical profession rather than, cage fighting or something like that. And just came out really beat out of it and absolutely incapable of relating to the world except in the The only people I could relate to were Vietnam vets, ex-cons, and motorcycle people. And they all kind of knew I wasn't really one of them, but they all kind of knew I could talk, and so I've always kind of gotten along with people. Mm-hmm. But this inability to converse, the inability to get over the PTSD, relate to the original problem, and move on with my life has eluded me for 30 years. So I spent 30 years studying it. You know, I looked at the Zen, Tibetan Buddhism, New Age stuff, Freud and Jung and all kinds of Western psychologists, and the whole time trying to figure out why the hell myself and, you know, Vietnam vets and everybody else can't get over PTSD. What's the secret? What's the big problem? Everybody says, you know, your brain, your Aunt Tilly tells you, just drop it. There's nothing, no problem. It's you. It's not, just drop it. But I came to the conclusion that the hypervigilance, the intensity of PTSD is coming from the fact that the original trauma can repeat, and that the hypervigilance and everything else, the willingness to talk, the unwillingness to talk, the inability to have ordinary conversations, and so forth, is coming from the constant vigilance that is required to prevent the original trauma from happening again. And this would be the same for, you know, army, military, the incarcerated, victims of accidents, victims of abuse of all sorts. The main problem, the reason they're constantly watching everything, is for the danger of a repetition of that original trauma. And I concluded that, you know, much as I might like my great Aunt Tilly, she's wrong. You can't just drop it, because it could actually recur again. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of a constant oppression, a constant feeling that you have to be alert, things have to be done right now, or it's going to happen again. And so the PTSD is kind of manic, kind of running around. He's unable to talk to people. It's dangerous to not talk about the trauma. It's dangerous to talk about it. And in the meantime, he's maintaining a very ordinary kind of a front. But in the background is like a growing schizophrenia or a growing psychosis that could also break out. So there's this constant tension between the breakout of the stuff and the schizophrenia. What seems like schizophrenia in the background is really that you can't relate to your dreams and to your psychology and to your demons directly enough because of the PTSD, that you're constantly pushing in the background, trying to prevent the trauma from reoccurring, and this is growing in the background. So you have this double thing going on. You're trying to prevent the trauma from recurring. In the background, you got what seems like schizophrenia. If you didn't have PTSD, it'd probably just be bad moods that you would relate to, but instead you're pushing it back, pushing it back, pushing it back, and it's dangerous to let it up front, because in one case, trauma could recur. In the other case, the psychosis could break out too much, too fast, rather than little by little, as it should have had since the early trauma.
Okay.
So you're stuck in this weird bind. Yeah, you got to stay alert constantly to prevent this thing from recurring. I know an ambulance driver, an EMT, and, you know, I was talking to him in a bar one time, PTSD came up, and he said to me, "You know what? I don't miss anything." You know, and his trauma was kind of, you know, the good-hearted sort of trauma, where he's out there seeing the traumas of others and trying to take care of people who are dying or who died, and all these awful things that happened to an EMT.
Right.
But he says, "I don't miss anything." And I think that would be true of all PTSD sufferers. I immediately recognize, yeah, I don't miss anything either. I see everything that happens. But at the same time, the danger recurring, the buildup in the background of demons and angels and things you could handle very ordinarily if you didn't have to constantly watch for that trauma recurring. And then through all this, the research and the study, you know, I did Zen, I did Tibetan Buddhist practices, nothing weird, you know, New Age stuff. I never did anything weird. I just kind of...
Okay, let me stop you right there, Phil. Look, I want to back up just a little bit. I've noticed that a lot of people that come out of prison have got these social interaction issues. People that have been outgoing in their previous life, when they come home, including me, kind of stumble socially. Is everyone who's having that issue, is that, I know you say that's part of like a symptom, but not everyone has post-traumatic stress disorder that comes out of prison, right? Just because they're having that issue. Could you address that?
Well, that's true, but a lot of people also don't know that that's what's going on.
Okay.
This poor socialization, in some ways, if you've got the floor, there's no problem. You can put yourself out there and have a chat. If there's an interaction, all of a sudden you kind of lose yourself, and that danger of things recurring, so you want to withdraw. And a normal conversation, just an ordinary give and take of a chat, becomes draining rather than relaxing. And you feel the need to back off, oh my God, because you're not watching closely enough. You're letting go. And when you let go, there's this danger of a recurrence.
Okay. Okay.
And that recurrence is, I think, the main thing. And not everyone gets PTSD. Why some people do and some people don't, that's been, plaguing the military for centuries. You know, they have combat fatigue and combat shock, and then now it's called PTSD. And it seems no one really understands why it is that some people go through these horrific experiences and come out just fine, and others get PTSD. And, you know, we could make all kinds of arguments. You could say your great aunt Tilly was right. They just don't let go. But again, I don't think it's well understood, but I think it is a reality that those who get PTSD need to deal with it, or they're going to be kind of outsiders in the culture.
Okay. The reason I address the social interaction skills is I've been interested lately in the idea of some sort of a program before people are released from incarceration that addresses social interaction skills, and that I know of some programs that are like that where people live in a therapeutic community and the social interaction skills are a part of that, and they work on those while they're in the therapeutic community. I mean, it's almost like a no-brainer, but don't you think that everyone that's coming out of prison would benefit from that kind of a program?
Well, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, certainly it makes sense, but it has to be based on an understanding of the PTSD and the withdrawal. So there is certainly an interest in having a normal conversation, sitting down with some friends, having a chat, and not thinking about trauma or psychology or anything, just having a nice chat. And those skills are important. And again, for me, it strikes me that the real problem is that relaxation causes you to drop the hypervigilance, which puts you in danger of either the craziness in the background breaking out or the repetition of the trauma in the front breaking out. And both of them would be more damaging to the social situation than being too quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in my case, what would happen, I lost my wife, my job, my house, and all of a sudden I'm 26 years old, I'm thrown into this world of hospitals and so forth, can't think about what actually happened. And then throughout 30 years, every time I relax, I lose my girlfriend, my job, my house, just everything disappears in the same, and it's very recognizable as a repetition of the original trauma. And so for me, I've often made a choice in sacrificing a nice ordinary conversation and hanging out with silent old vets instead, because at least it was something social. We didn't talk very much, maybe an occasional joke, maybe some rude comments of strangers passing by, but nothing else. And that was somehow less of a long-term danger for the social situation.
Right. Right.
And you know, what one guy I knew was an old bearded fellow who lived in an RV. After a long time, yeah, he kind of wept that something was up. After a long time, he told me that he had done 8 tours in Vietnam as a medic. And they kept calling, it was supposed to be 1 year each time. They kept calling him back because he was good at it, and they needed that. And he came back, and he's just a real hermit. He's actually a very pleasant guy, but he doesn't talk more than most people with PTSD. I think you find a lot of, again, for prisoners, there's an extra bind in that it's socially compromising to say you're an ex-offender if you don't do it really, really well.
Right.
You know, yeah, I mean, some people can do that and get away with it, and not only get away with it, but gain the respect of the people that talk and feel, okay, he's done his time, he knows how to be, not to scare people, I guess. But a lot of people just can't do that, and that's socially compromised. And so the need to talk about it is further compromised by a potential need for secrecy. And so the PTSD, whether everybody gets it or not, is a serious problem for the individuals. And we end up with ex-offenders and ex-vets and so forth who are not participating in society at all, but they could if the PTSD was correctly addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. The worst, they always look very, very normal, except they stare and they don't talk. Everybody says, oh, he's just faking, he's just lazy,
let me interrupt you there. What about the other end of the spectrum? Or instead of being overly passive, are there PTSD people that are overly aggressive? In other words, they're not assertive, they're not passive, they're aggressive.
I think that's quite possible. And again, I think that's more for people who were involved. See, in my case, I was Peace Corps and medical things. Mm-hmm. And so the environment where the trauma occurred was not a violent one. It was one sort of inflicted by circumstance and medicine. So it's actually much gentler for me, but I lose everything. And I think people whose trauma originally was violent need to relate to it in some way, calming it or, you know, trying to use it up or whatnot, but trying to prevent a repetition of something that's self-destructive or, you know, of themselves or of their entire lifestyle.
Okay. Let me stop you right there. We're going to take a break, and then when we come back, let's talk about the ways to address it, okay? These
right.
different ways that you've outlined. We're going to take a short break. My guest today is Dr. Philip Brolic, and we're talking about the post-traumatic stress disorder. We're going to be right back after this. My name is Rodney Mathers, and you're on the Journey of Hope.
Listen to the show. Now it's time to talk about the Jam Buddy chord chart. If you're learning how to play music, this is something you need. It's the Jam Buddy chord chart. What it does is it teaches you something called the Nashville numbering system, and it enables you to play songs no matter what the instrument is in any key. This makes you more viable as a player. You want to check that out. It's the Jam Buddy chord chart. Just look over to the right of the podcast and there's a link for it you can click on. It's the Jam Buddy chord chart.
Thank you.
Welcome back. My guest today is Dr. Philip Brolic. We're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, and we had been speaking a little bit about the symptoms, about the social interaction problems and so forth that ex-offenders might experience. I know that, when I would go to a job right after I got home, a job interview, you're supposed to be nervous for a job interview. I mean, that's normal, but it was just excruciatingly difficult for me. And I'm wondering now, maybe if it wasn't a little abnormal. I will tell you, Dr. Brolic, that I have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder because of my experiences in prison. And so I know that it's a tough road to hoe if it's not addressed. And I'm interested in the ways that you address it. You're talking about Eastern and Western sorts of philosophy combined. Tell us about your approach. And I really like this. Tell us about how you teach people to address a post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, the main thing is it's a dangerous thing, and it has to be done kind of exactly right. Talking about it is dangerous, not talking about it is dangerous. Looking at your early life psychology or 12-step psychology, these things, of course, are helpful, but you even got to be cautious when you're doing that, because you don't want everything you push back to break out too quickly, and you don't want the PTSD to cause a repetition of the original trauma. So the person with PTSD has to be especially careful. There's even a danger. I still feel that the psychiatrists won't agree with me, so don't take me as a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. But I've always resisted taking drugs because I was afraid I would just end up homeless with a stupid smile rather than near homeless and too intense for everybody. So the crucial thing is being very cautious about it. Most of them know that intuitively, and then a psychiatrist or a counselor or an AA meeting, someone says, no, just drop it. We all kind of know it's dangerous to just drop it, but you want to. And then you have the Eastern psychologies with Zen and Tibetan Buddhism and all those sorts of things, where just dropping it is considered the recommendation for everything. And there are, in many prisons now, there's a lot of Buddhist meditation groups, and they're out there teaching how to sit and how to relate to your psychology. But I think an awful lot of them really miss PTSD. I think most of the culture misses PTSD. Again, whether all people get it or not, if you've got it, it's got to be dealt with. And there's a danger in everything you try of a repetition of the trauma or a too fast breakout of what you've been pushing away, so you can keep your eyes out for that coming trauma. And with the Zen, one of the conclusions I've come up with, and through the 30 years of meditating, I've meditated about, it's real, say I've averaged 14 hours a week of meditation for about 28 years. And still, I always had this weird thing. I'm feeling cured when I'm letting go, but at the same time, the traumas are repeating. So, the Zen posture and the Tibetan practice and so forth, everything seems to be getting better. But at the same time, if I look at my life directly, it's repeating again. I'm losing another job, another girlfriend, all in one swell poop. And this was a personal issue for me. And I think the PTSD is not being addressed directly enough by either Western or Eastern psychology as an independent problem. And I think one possible solution is kind of a middle ground for the middle ground of Buddhism, relaxing the posture and sort of staying with hypervigilance, letting go and looking, and not sitting up bolt upright straight, which a lot of people with PTSD are very, very tough, and we'll sit up straight and we'll do it very rigidly. But I think that might be part of the problem, where it's both curing and aggravating the PTSD at the same time. A real odd sort of thing. You feel better, but the world is still reacting strangely to you. Mm-hmm. And you feel like you're more alert, but in some ways your hypervigilance is making you even more intense. And so I think with, you know, again, it's relatively, it's not common, I don't think, in prisons, but there are a lot of prisons that are having Zen and Buddhist programs to teach meditation. And I think the main thing is, especially with Zen, the rigidity of the posture gives you a feeling things are getting better, but you look around at your life, and it's still recurring. Mm-hmm. And so I think a relaxation to posture, and the Tibetans these days, who have, and I've seen lots of them, who have tremendous problems with PTSD due to depression of China, torture, and God knows what else is going on. Mm-hmm. When you see them meditating, they look lazy. I mean, they wrap themselves in their shawls, and they lean on their tables, and they kind of daydream and look around and so forth. But they don't go for the rigid posture that's so popular with Zen. Mm-hmm. And Tibetans are very, you know, quiet. They don't really say much. They just want you to read the books and try. Mm-hmm. But I do kind of wonder sometimes if they're allowing those rather casual postures because it does work with PTSD. There's something about, you know, the hypervigilance that's getting cranked up by a rigid posture, and a letting go that's allowed better with slouching a bit and daydreaming a bit, and, you know, daydream and get back to the Zen, daydream and get back to the Tibetan. And for that reason, I think, and again, I don't want to say I've got a definite final answer. I just think the 30 years experience I've had and the training I had in psychology and Eastern makes it possible for me to bring things a step closer to a solution. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I'm saying, that Eastern religion, particularly Buddhism, and their letting go and their sitting practice get you to look at the psychosis is building in the background because you can't look at it without dropping your hypervigilance and the hypervigilance. And I think by relaxing the posture and doing the Buddhist meditations, now you might fall asleep, you might find yourself watching TV.
You know what? I was gonna say that one of the problems that I've had with meditation is I get sleepy. And I've mentioned this to people before, and apparently it's kind of common, which is good to know.
Well, and actually, it's a good thing. One of the basic, and this is where the Zen posture is so rigid, and the room is so dark. They want you to mix being alert, holding your posture rigidly, while you get kind of dreamy and sleepy, and that's sort of the skill you build, like a military guy standing at attention in the sun till he practically passes out. You're sitting in that rigid posture and you're practically falling asleep, and you're kind of mixing those two, and that's a good thing. But again, with the PTSD, I think the more rigid you get with the posture, the more you're cranking up hypervigilance rather than cranking up letting go, and the dreaminess should bring up, the sleepiness and the dreaminess should bring up that the crazy that's building in the background. Mm-hmm. In a way that you can handle it. And again, if I were to, you know, again, what I'm saying is I don't have a final answer, but
this, well, none of us do.
The central problem is that the need to prevent the trauma from recurring, the hypervigilance, you gotta watch. In order to watch, you're pushing back your angels and demons. And then the angels and demons are building up in the background, and all of a sudden, it's more than you can handle in 1 second. It's something you should have handled through your sleeping at night and your daily life and bitching and moaning to your girlfriend, whining and moaning to your girlfriend and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it's building up too much. So that dreaminess and falling asleep sometimes when you're doing it, that's fine. And I suspect people would get better. There's a meditation that I've actually put out for people to look at, where you do the meditation not sitting on a cushion, but laying on a couch. You know, and again, with people with PTSD, you got to wonder if they even have a couch. You know, they might be homeless. An awful lot of vets, an awful lot of ex-offenders. You know, but the only thing they place they have where they can sit up normally is an AA or an NA meeting.
Right.
So laying on the couch or leaning against the wall next to the gas station, you know, try to get comfy, and then think about not doing it, but just kind of waiting. And waiting is the important thing. And it's like if your car broke down, you know, and you're in a nice, quiet neighborhood, nothing's going to happen, you have the money for a tow truck, and you got to wait 45 minutes. For a lot of people, especially guys, for a lot of people, when that happens, suddenly you get this very nice sense of nothing can be done relaxation. You just kind of lean against the car, or you sit on the curb, and you wait. You're waiting for the guy to turn up. So if you kind of lean against the gas station wall or lay down on your couch and just wait like that. Wait like the tow truck is coming. There's nothing to be done. And, you know, you can't do a project. You can't worry about somebody running out of town or whatever else. You just wait. And with that kind of waiting, you just lay there and wait for a thing. Now, sometimes you fall asleep, which is typical, but at some point you can do it for a longer period of time, and you're just laying there waiting. And what you're waiting for is to simply kind of find yourself without thinking about it, doing something. Now, you don't make any plan. You don't think, I'm going to write a book, or I'm going to walk over and get some more beers or whatnot. You just lay there and you wait. And then you find yourself at some point kind of doing something, taking a walk, you know, working on your computer, whatever's going on, and you didn't really notice you'd done that. And that, I think, is very clarifying for both the intensity and the buildup in the background. That's the kind of letting go that doesn't make things worse.
Okay.
And it takes time, but at some point, you just kind of find yourself, you know, the way I say it, is pleasantly going about the business of doing something vaguely interesting.
Okay,
you know,
I'm going to have to...
Instead of, you know, walking to the drugstore and you're going to buy a new lighter or something.
Right.
And you walk to the drugstore and it's kind of a nice day and it's, you know, and nobody's really bothering you, you hope. and you go to the drugstore and you buy a lighter and you leave again. And it's just, you know, casual and sort of interesting.
Okay. Dr. Philip Braylett, we're going to have to cut it off. There's a very interesting discussion. Dr. Philip Braylett, the book is called Memoirs of a Dharma Who Survived. I think there are some other books, too. Just real quick, Phil, can you tell us how to get to your webpage and how to find your books?
Well, you can find the stuff Blaming Jaffe. So it's J-A-P-H-Y. Is a guy's name. It's kind of a nickname from a book. But Blaming Jaffe, if you type in Blaming Jaffe or Blaming Jaffe Writer, you should find all kinds of goodies.
Okay.
And the website is there. The blog is there. A lot of self-important whining is there. but you can find everything. And I do think the book would be a contribution to, you know, people who want to figure out this back and forth of crazy in the background and intense in the foreground, and the fact that it might be a better choice to stay staring and quiet than or to recognize staring and quiet while you work on your social skills.
Okay. Good deal. Philip, I want to thank you so much for being here. Excellent discussion. We'll have to have you back sometime and continue this. Philip Braylett, thank you so much for being on the Journey of Hope today.
Thank you for having me.
My name's Rodney Mathers. We're going to take another short, quick break, and when we come back, oh, just a little bit more. We'll be right back after this.
Well, we've come to the end of another show. I want to thank my special guest today, Philip Brolic, and I want to remind you that if God is for you, who can be against you? We're going to see you next time right here on the Journey of Hope.